Oceana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT presents Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Booger, up and in! With 2 seconds left, Notre Dame leads!
Malpas again, backhands, he scores!
Down to the corner, Jablonski, three is good!
Andrew steps in, he's going to throw deep for T.Y., he's got it!
Flips to Jenkins, three for the win, it's good! Villanova wins it!
He dives, it is a touchdown! New England wins!
Adios! Cubs win their ninth in a row!
Miles Boykin is in the end zone!
The Irish have come back!
Your hosts are Eric Hansen and Darren Pritchett.
Good evening, everyone. Sports Beat on the air for this May the 30th. Eric Hansen is the Fighting Irish football insider for the South Bend Tribune. He's back in our WSBT studios. I'm Darren Pritchett, traveling with the South Bend Cubs. We are in Midland, Michigan tonight. We've already played our game. We played at 10:35 this morning. And South Bend picked up the 5-3 victory over the Great Lakes Loons. Final game of the three-game series will be a rubber game tomorrow night at 7:05 on WSBT Radio. Sports Beat is brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. By Goshen Heart and Vascular. Know your numbers. Visit GoshenHeartAndVascular.org. And by Blackthorn Golf Club and the Blackthorn Card. It's just $99 at Blackthorn, and it gets you up to 80% off rounds of golf, including cart, at Blackthorn Golf Club, the site of the Symetra Tour's Four Winds Invitational, June 8th through the 10th. Coming up this evening on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, we have a couple of pieces of Notre Dame football news for this Wednesday, a start time for Navy, and a verbal commitment. We'll get to that information coming up in just a couple of moments. Also coming up at 5:30, we're going to talk a little Notre Dame baseball. What should the standard be for the Irish since joining the ACC? We were scheduled to talk to Mike Rooney, a former Notre Dame baseball player, a part of ESPN's college baseball tournament coverage. We're going to have to reschedule. Mike texted me this morning saying, my voice is just about gone. I've got a bunch of baseball to call this weekend. Can I take a rain check? So we're going to try to do something next week with Mike Rooney. So we will try to get that to you next week. We have a My Five question of the day. The five Notre Dame football players that have had the best 2018 so far. Next hour, we're going to be joined at 6:10 by Kaylee Rooker. She is from St. Joe, Michigan, a junior golfer at St. Joe High School, and she has received a sponsor's exemption for the Four Winds Invitational at Blackthorn June 8th through the 10th. And we're going to talk to her about that opportunity. And also, she was an individual that was a part of the first tee out of Benton Harbor. So we're going to talk about how important that was to her. And she's actually helping youngsters now get involved in the game of golf with that same program. So that interview coming up in just about 1 hour. Also, we'll get to rapid fire. We'll take a look at what happened with the South Bend Cubs today. That's all later here on 96.1 WSBT. Eric, how are you this evening?
Doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. We've got bright sunshine here in Midland. I assume it's probably rain most of the day today. That's what the forecast was calling for back in South Bend.
Well, we got rain here in the afternoon, and it is raining now, and we're going to have it for several hours.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
But it's probably at least fairly warm. That's all we care about.
Well, my disappointment was that I didn't get to see the Great Lakes Loons in person.
Well, they'll be in town later this year. I know that's like your team you can't wait to see because of the symbol and just the name itself. I'll tell you what, if you came to a game here at Dow Diamond, first, it's a wonderful facility. I mean, it's beautiful. But they play this loon sound like 50 million times a game, and after 2 days, it's just kind of like, I'm done. I mean, when they announce the starting lineup, they say each player's name, they play the sound effect. If something happens, they play the sound effect. And I'm just kind of done with the bird calls. And I got one more day to go, I guess, to get through it. So I'll do my best. I do want to mention this because I've had a couple of people on Twitter ask me today about something that happened during the South Bend Cub game. So let me just cover this really quick. During the game today, Brandon Hughes, South Bend Cubs outfielder, was at the plate. It's an Education Day game, so there were 5,000 youngsters in the ballpark, just like we have at Four Winds Field several times in May. And Brandon hit an absolute scorching line drive down the right field line. And a little girl, I would say she was probably 8 years old, was standing up on a grassy hill talking to friends and had her back to home plate. And unfortunately, the baseball, that again, it was an absolute smoke line drive. It looked like hit her in the back of the head. And she went down just as soon as the ball hit her. It was extremely scary. She was attended to. They probably attended to her for 7-8 minutes. And then an emergency person came down who was a part of the group helping her, picked her up and carried her onto the concourse, and we heard an ambulance come. So she was taken away, and we're trying to get an update. So I know a lot of people listening to the game today are probably wondering what happened to the little girl. We have not been able to find out yet. In fact, I've even contacted our manager, Jimmy Gonzalez, who talks to the Great Lakes manager and might have some information to pass along. So I'm hoping to get that, because I know people listening, it was scary to even listen on the radio what was going on as I described it. And so hopefully everything's okay. We got our fingers crossed, but just very, very scary. And that brings up the debate, Eric, that's been going on throughout baseball. How far do you put the protective netting up in baseball parks to protect fans? Now, everybody's going at least to the dugouts now in all levels of professional baseball, but there are still many ballparks where not too far away from the field and not too far down the lines, balls go firing into the stands and hitting seats and hitting individuals. I know in Dayton, they have now taken basically every line drive out of play from foul pole to foul pole is netting. So anywhere from foul pole to foul pole, you cannot get a foul ball unless it goes high in the air and comes down. They have an extremely high net, even at the foul poles, to protect the fans at their ballpark down in Dayton. And I know there's a couple of Midwest League teams that just went to covering the dugouts, and I've seen a lot of people hit in a couple of ballparks in the Midwest League, and it is scary. I saw one guy get hit right in the chest by a line drive right behind the Cub dugout a couple of years ago on the road. So it's not fun to see this happening. And Eric, my thing is, for a long time, I felt like, you know what, if you're not going to pay attention, don't sit there. But I've actually changed my tune. I think the netting is a good thing, because so many people come to the ballpark to talk. You eat food. You look down at your food. You miss a pitch. And you know what? Everybody's on their phone now. You're always checking Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram. Maybe you're getting a text, and you're texting an individual. So often in a baseball game, you have your eyes away from the field, that I have kind of changed my tune. I think it's really necessary that we do whatever we can to protect the fans. I know a lot of people don't like to look through the netting, and I get that, but at this point, Eric, I've just seen too many people hit. It's just awfully scary, and phones in hand are making things even worse, in my opinion.
I would agree with you, and in the few times that I've been behind the netting, I didn't mind it at all. I felt like I could still see the game just as well, and it didn't bother me. I thought the safety factor very much outweighed whatever inconvenience that I guess there would be.
So if I get an update during the show, I'll pass it along. And again, I thank some of the listeners for reaching out, trying to find out what happened, and we'll see if we can get some information to you. Hopefully all is well with that little girl up here in Midland. Eric, it was announced today that Notre Dame and Navy college football action from San Diego, which is scheduled for October the 27th, now has a start time and another primetime game for Notre Dame. This game will kick off at 8 o'clock on 96.1 WSBT. So as we think ahead, October 27th is a long time away, and I think that's about the seventh game of the Notre Dame football season, actually the eighth game of the Notre Dame football season. So a lot can happen between now and then. But what should we expect, Eric, out of the midshipmen when the Irish go out to San Diego to take on Navy?
Well, if he's healthy this year, they're going to see Malcolm Perry playing quarterback. He got dinged up right before Notre Dame played Navy last November in Notre Dame Stadium. So Garrett Lewis and Zach Abey kind of tag-teamed that game. Zach had been the unquestioned starter. Malcolm Perry came in, rushed for 250 yards in each of his first two starts. And so that kind of was the end of Zach Abey. He is now a wide receiver for Navy. And Malcolm Perry will be the quarterback. The thing was, he is not a very experienced passer. He threw two passes last year and one of those was an interception. He worked on his passing during the spring. It was a little bit uneven, but his 8.6 yards per carry, and that's combined slot back and quarterback, is a Navy record for yards per carry. Probably the fastest Navy quarterback Notre Dame has seen in the Kelly era. And then on defense, you're going to see a rebuilding defense. So it's going to be kind of the same formula with Navy. You got to get out front of them. And be, if you're up a couple of scores, then they have to kind of play your game and throw the ball. And so it's never really easy with Navy, but dynamic quarterback, real questionable defense.
And you think back to the game, November 18th at Notre Dame Stadium, Notre Dame and Navy 17-17 going to the fourth quarter. And do you remember who caught the game-winning touchdown pass in that game?
Pretty sure it was Kevin Stefferson.
That's right. In the third quarter, Notre Dame tied it with a 30-yard touchdown pass, Wimbush to Kevin Stefferson. And then with 11:49 to go in the fourth, Stefferson caught a 9-yard touchdown pass from Wimbush to complete an 11-play, 80-yard drive. Notre Dame took the lead 24-17 and held on to win the game over the midshipmen by that score. Of course, Stefferson no longer a part of the Fighting Irish football program. But he had a big day for the Irish against the midshipmen. 5 catches for 103 and 2 touchdowns. In that game, only 2 other passes were completed. Miles Boykin had 2 for 33. Chase Claypool, 2 for 28. Brandon Wimbush was 9 out of 18, 164 yards, 2 touchdowns. And that was the phase of the season, Eric, where everybody started taking Miami's defensive blueprint and using that against the Irish. Navy tried that. Now, Notre Dame averaged 5.3 yards per carry on the ground, which was pretty good. But with the advantage Notre Dame had up front, 31 for 163, I guess I would have thought it would have been a bigger day for the Irish, knowing that they were averaging well over 280 rushing yards per game. But again, that kind of goes back to everybody saying at that point of the season, Brandon Wimbush, go ahead and beat us if you can.
Yeah, very much so. And Navy played that game very well. And so, again, this year, will we see a better passing Brandon Wimbush? Will we see a passing all of Malcolm Perry? You know, he caught 13 passes last year, but he only threw one completion last year and only attempted 2. I mean, that's going to be the story of Notre Dame season, and we won't have to wait very long to see what's going on and see if there's progress, because Michigan is going to be really good against the run. They're going to be really good against the pass. They're going to be able to probably dictate a lot of what Notre Dame is doing on offense, and they're going to test Brandon Wimbush. They're going to, I would imagine, you know, load the box and mm-hmm. say, Brandon, go ahead and beat us with your arm. See if you can do that. And then we'll see. And then, you know, there's not another really good defense on the schedule until you get to Virginia Tech in early October. But, you know, those are the games Notre Dame lost last year. Even Stanford wasn't a great defense. They had some really good individuals, but they had a really good game plan, and they were able to put it on Wimbush, and Wimbush wasn't able to perform. And that's why I think a lot of people were howling for Ian Book in the spring, because LSU had a very good defense, and Ian Book in relief was able to defeat that defense. But I think that Brandon Wimbush is still the higher ceiling guy, and mm-hmm. in the spring he had a better spring. And so he's going to have to do it with the bright lights on against Michigan. But and he's going to have to do it with the bright lights in San Diego, since it is a night game.
Well, the weather should be really nice out in San Diego, and I'm assuming, I'm looking at the name of the stadium, is that the old Murph that they're playing at, Jack Murphy Stadium, the old Murph?
I believe it is.
SDCCU Stadium is what it's listed as, so I'm assuming there was a sponsorship name of that facility. So I'm assuming it's where San Diego State plays, and that would be the Murph. Okay, so we've got a start time for Notre Dame Navy, 8 o'clock kickoff on 96.1 WSBT. So that means our old Game Day Sports Beat pregame show will be on the air from 5 until 7 o'clock that day. And we should also mention that the Navy game in San Diego starts the gauntlet. the stretch of the season that, let's be honest, Eric, is very concerning how the team is going to fight through the travel. You take on Navy in San Diego. Then you go to Northwestern and Evanston. That's not bad. Home to take on Florida State. Then you go to New York to take on Syracuse. And the following week, you fly to the other coast, to L.A., to take on USC. Even if two losses gives you still a chance to get into the playoff, let's use that as the barometer. Notre Dame cannot afford to have more than one loss going into that stretch, in my opinion. It's going to be very difficult to go 5-0, even if you're a great football team. There's just a lot of built-in challenges. Do you agree?
I would agree. I think the couple things that I like is that Notre Dame has some tough November games if you are trying to get into the playoff, playing Florida State. If Florida State is as good as advertised, and playing USC on the road, if they are also a ranked team, that's going to help you. But the thing is, you got to beat those teams. They're hard.
Sure.
And the way that the schedule is stacked is not ideal. I had some guy tweet to me today, and he says, Notre Dame players come to Notre Dame to play in Yankee Stadium in games like this. They come to Notre Dame to win championships. And, yeah, you can play in Yankee Stadium, but you got to be smart with your scheduling about it. They've done the Yankee Stadium thing before. In the Shamrock Series, and they've done it in a bowl game. Unless you want to end up playing your bowl game in Yankee Stadium, you've got to schedule smart. And I don't like this, and I'm belaboring the point. I don't like the four games on the road. I didn't think the Shamrock Series game was necessary this year. I think it would have much been better served this team and its playoff aspirations to have that as a home game, have that as senior day the week after playing Florida State. You mentioned, is this the Murph? Yes, it is the former Murph. San Diego County Credit Union Stadium used to be Jack Murphy Stadium. It's hosted Super Bowls. It's a cool venue, and it's a great place to play. From what I understand, Notre Dame and Navy had no say in the 8 o'clock start. One thing that Notre Dame is going to do that I think is really smart is instead of trying to fly back Saturday night after the game and getting home and having to kind of reset your body clocks when you get home at 5 in the morning or whatever, they are going to stay overnight Saturday night and then fly back on Sunday, which I think makes more sense. You kind of lose a day, but I think by keeping your body clocks regular, I think... doing this, going into that stretch, because that's the first of the five-game stretch where four are away from Notre Dame Stadium, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Does make a lot of sense. Good information right there. Eric Hansen, Fighting Irish Football Insider. For the South Bend Tribune, I'm Darren Pritchett. One more Notre Dame football topic to get to, as the Irish picked up a verbal commitment today. There are verbal commitments of quarterbacks, and then there are verbal commitments of special teams players. So the reason why this wasn't the lead story today, Eric, was today a punter has verbally committed to the Fighting Irish. So normally recruiting is our lead story, but not today. And no disrespect to Jay Bramblett, who is considered, it sounds like, Eric, as one of the top punters in the country.
Right, and usually the people that do the punter ratings are not rivals in 247 Sports. It's Chris Saylor Kicking. And some of that is that they are coached through Chris Saylor Kicking at some point. But the elite kickers and punters go to specialists. They go to places like Chris Saylor Kicking where they're going to get expert advice and expert coaching. And so this is supposedly the number one or two punter in the country, depending on who you're listening to. And Notre Dame needs that. I mean, if they want to take special teams seriously, they need to go out and get the best guy. They got him out of Nick Saban's backyard. He originally visited last year during the season for the Wake Forest game, which was played in the rain. He came back and was in town recently, picked up an offer from Notre Dame, and turned that into a verbal commitment.
Now, there's a story on Bramblett right now at IndyInsider.com. Of course, a story coming tomorrow in the South Bend Tribune. If you don't mind, I'm just going to pick a little piece of information out of the IndyInsider.com piece on Bramblett. According to stats listed on Bramblett's Coles kicking profile, he averaged 39 yards on 56 punts. and he pinned 25 of those punts inside the 20-yard line during his junior season at Tuscaloosa Hillcrest High School down in Alabama. And the timing really is perfect, Eric, for the Irish to get a commitment for a punter in this class because time is running out on Tyler Newsome at Notre Dame.
Right. This will be Tyler Newsome's fifth and final season at Notre Dame. I called him the heir apparent on Twitter to Tyler Newsome, and somebody pointed out, is he the heir apparent because of Tyler Newsome's unique hairstyle? And I am not sure about that. It looks like he is way behind in terms of exotic hairdos, but in terms of being a really good punter, it sounds like Notre Dame's got a good one.
Eric, punters are to punt and not be heard.
Although Tyler Newsome is a heck of a, you know, he's a captain.
Yeah, I know. So, I know. You know what? If you do your one job that you have well, you can do whatever you want. That's the thing about punters. You have one job. You have to practice the same thing all day. You don't have to worry about anything else. Now, there's a couple of different punts you can do, obviously, but you know what I'm saying. They have one job, and that's to punt the football, and you should be able to do it well. And if you do, by golly, you can chatter all you want. How about that?
Well, I'll tell you what, when you saw Texas, did you see Texas punter Dixon? Did you ever see him play? That guy was amazing. I think he was from Australia. He came out early and he got drafted. Punters can make a difference in flipping field position. And certainly if you can't catch the ball and have fumble fingers or you can't react, when things break down, that's a problem. Tyler Newsome has done a pretty good job of that. He's had some inconsistencies over the years, but you definitely want to invest in a frontline punter. They're going to have to get a replacement for Justin Yoon. I think they believe Jonathan Doerr can do both jobs, but
okay.
We'll see if they want to grab another kicker, because what if Jonathan Doerr gets hurt? Do you have confidence in your walk-on that he's going to be able to make big field goals and kick off and get it into the end zone for you? So it'll be interesting to see if Notre Dame goes down the kicker aisle during this summer.
Well, since you're talking about special teams, I think something that will be intriguing is with Notre Dame tweaking some stuff on special teams, trying to find answers, trying to find difference-making players and plays from that unit. If they're going to dig a little deeper into the starting lineup on offense or defense to try to help out special teams. I mean, they went down that route a little bit last year, but I wonder if they add a couple of more players, try to make a difference.
You know, Brian Polian talked about that a little bit, and he definitely has his eye on some players. I don't think Brian Kelly's going to hold back. I think sometimes it was maybe players themselves that held back that didn't feel like they could do it. But I think there's more buy-in. He seemed to be much more optimistic that there are both the buy-in and the personnel to make a leap that for this year. So last year, they basically went from disasters that lost games to being kind of a below-average team that where the special teams didn't win you games, but they didn't lose you games.
Right.
The next step is to have it enhance your chances of winning games.
Okay, so Jay Bramblett verbally commits to the Irish. He is a punter, and the October 27th Notre Dame-Navy game in San Diego will kick off at 8 o'clock on WSBT Radio. So that's some Notre Dame football news. We'll get to a little baseball talk coming up next. We'll talk about Notre Dame baseball. We got some Major League Baseball to news. The X Factor in the NL Central with question marks after that statement was in action today. Tell you what he did and if he really is an X factor in this NL Central race. We'll get to that and a whole lot more coming up as Sports Beat continues. Eric and Darren with you from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. Eric Hansen is the Fighting Irish football insider for the South Bend Tribune. I'm Darren Pritchett. A couple of baseball notes for you. The Cubs beat the Pirates last night 8-6. As I mentioned, Hendricks is going today for the Cubs in Pittsburgh. And we're on May the 30th, so the standings becoming a little more realistic. Right now, it is Milwaukee in first place, four games ahead of the Chicago Cubs in the National League Central. The Brewers are 36-21, Chicago 29-22. Yu Darvish had an MRI on his arm, came back okay, no structural damage, so that's good news for Chicago. But also there was a report this afternoon that reliever C.J. Edwards goes on the disabled list. He had an MRI on his right shoulder, and it showed inflammation, so he joins Yu Darvish on the DL. Righty Corey Mazzoni was called up from AAA Iowa to take Edwards' place in the bullpen. So, Eric, with the Brewers right now on top of the National League Central, the Cubs are right there within striking distance. They were 5.5 behind the Brewers at the All-Star break last year, and they just flew right by Milwaukee as soon as the All-Star break ended. St. Louis right now is 5 back, and Pittsburgh is 6.5 back. Now, I just mentioned in the update, the Brewers took the rubber game of the 3-game series from St. Louis today, 3-2. Alex Reyes, the young hard-throwing right-hander, was a bullpen guy mainly for St. Louis in 16. He did get a couple of starts. Then had Tommy John surgery as all of last year, made his triumphant debut today with the Cardinals after dominating the minors in some rehab starts. And he went only 4 innings today. He was taken out for precautionary reasons. His fastball was off a couple of ticks in the 4th inning, so they took him out. Apparently there's no injury. But when you think about X factors, that can mean different things to different people. But is there any chance that Alex Reyes could be an X factor in the NL Central race, or is the supporting cast around him not good enough in order for him to make that much of a difference in the NL Central race?
My question is, can he be a player manager? I'm just kidding.
We'll see what we can do.
Yeah, I think, especially with getting Carlos Martinez back here at some point, St. Louis is positioned really well with their pitching. The question is, can they get enough consistency in the bullpen, and can they get their offense going? Specifically, Dexter Fowler, Colton Wong. They're going to get Yadier Molina back sooner than later. It sounds like he's defied doctor's orders and is doing baseball-related activities, which surprises no one. But you know, they may have to add a piece even when they're completely healthy, even when everybody's back playing healthy. You know, they get the shortstop DeJong back. I still think they're a bat short of being a pretty good team. But I think they have the starting pitching. If they get those other pieces, I think they have the starting pitching to make this thing really interesting down the stretch. Now, they can't let Milwaukee wiggle away too far, because Milwaukee's looks like they're pretty good.
Well, I don't think you can call someone the X factor when the rest of the team around him is not going to put you in position to have a chance to win the Central. A week ago, I thought it might be possible, but I've kind of backed off that. To me, St. Louis has the best starting rotation in the division. The Brewers have the best bullpen, and the Cubs might have the best combination of two, if you think about it, which is kind of weird. They may not be the best in either category, but as a collective unit, the Cubs might have the best group. And St. Louis's bullpen is a mess. They cannot count on anybody outside of Jordan Hicks and Bud Norris to do the job. You had Tyler Lyons, a lefty, come in today to face the lefty Christian Yelich. And the first pitch he throws is hit out of the ballpark, and it was a bomb to center field, which tied the game at 2. And everything imploded from there. So they do have enough in the rotation to win the division. The bullpen of the offense is going to hold them back. So I'd love to call Alex Reyes the X factor. I'll say this, if the Cubs had Alex Reyes and he was coming off the disabled list, Eric, he would be the X factor for the Chicago Cubs. He would be the guy that probably would push them for sure past the Milwaukee Brewers. But let's face it, the Cubs supporting cast is a heck of a lot better than St. Louis's right now, and Alex Reyes is on the wrong team to be the X factor in the National League Central. Again, if he was with the Cubs, I would put him right on the spot. He would be my X factor.
Okay.
We'll see what happens with St. Louis taking on Pittsburgh tomorrow. You got the Pirates and the Cubs later tonight in Pittsburgh as Chicago tries to keep pace with the Brewers, led by Craig Counsell, and Pat Murphy is on the bench. A lot of Notre Dame South Bend flavor on that Brewers bench. Let's talk a little college baseball. Again, we were going to have Mike Rooney on today, former Notre Dame baseball player, one of the voices of ESPN's coverage of the College World Series and the entire NCAA tournament, but he's got the raspy voice working right now. He's got a lot of big games to call this weekend, so we're going to see if we can catch up with Mike maybe next week or before the College World Series and enjoy his baseball conversation. But when you think about Notre Dame baseball, Eric, they're coming off a 24-30 season. With Notre Dame joining the ACC a few years ago, I remember the day it was announced, we felt like the toughest challenge for any of the sports at Notre Dame to remain relevant was going to be in baseball. With the advantage of the teams in the South getting on the field earlier, the best players want to play in the bright sunshine, let's be perfectly honest. There's a lot of speed bumps that goes against Notre Dame baseball trying to be competitive with the Clemsons, with the Miamis, with the Florida States, North Carolina, NC State, Louisville. The list kind of goes on and on and on. Now, Paul Maneri in the Big East had great success. We had 50-win teams here, a trip to the College World Series in 2002. We actually had this debate at Four Winds Field the other day. If Notre Dame, under Maneri in the 90s and the 2000s, were in the ACC, how different would Notre Dame baseball look? And I think it's a fair question, because in the Big East, Eric, Rutgers, West Virginia were a couple of the main competitions for teams coming into X Stadium for the Fighting Irish. And that's a whole lot different than Clemson, North Carolina, NC State, Florida State. It's just a whole different ball game with those teams down in the South. So we knew this was going to be more challenging. And I still think Maneri's teams would have done very well. It would have been more difficult maybe to win 50 games like they did a handful of times. But I still think it's a team that would have been well over 500 in the ACC, knowing the talent that they had. But again, I think it would have been a whole lot more difficult. So we've now seen the Irish in the ACC for several years. And just as we kind of thought, it's a tough go in the ACC with all of the advantages some of those teams have on the Fighting Irish. So, Eric, that brings me to the question. As fans, as media members, however you want to look at this, what should the standard be now for Notre Dame baseball? Again, they're coming off a 24-30 season. They found a way to at least qualify for the ACC tournament. They had to win both games in pool play just to move on further when they lost to Miami. They were basically eliminated. Then they just played that second game against Clemson, and the Tigers, by golly, had 17 runs in the fourth inning en route to a 21-4 win. So as you evaluate where Notre Dame is in the college baseball world, which is in a different place from where they were in the Big East, what type of standards should we hold the Irish baseball team to?
Well, when I look at Mick Aoki's record, you had one good season, and that was 2015, and they went 17-13 in the ACC, 37-23 overall, and tied for second in their division in the ACC. Mm-hmm. And other than that, pretty much near or at the bottom of the ACC in his other four ACC years. And then in the Big East years, they never finished higher than seventh in the three Big East years. So I'm not seeing it. I thought they were a really good offensive team this year,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't have the pitching. And I think, going back to your thought on Paul Maneri, I think Paul Maneri would have had this team playing at a much higher level. Would they have had as many wins? Probably not.
No.
But they would have been in the NCAA tournament. I think he would have been able to recruit and use the ACC as a recruiting tool.
You stole my line.
Okay. And then, yeah. And you look at what he did when you threw him into the SEC, which is an amazing baseball conference.
Shark-infested waters.
Right. I realize LSU has got a lot of tradition, but there's a lot of other really good baseball programs, and he was immediate and consistent winner at LSU. And you had Pat Murphy before. I mean, that was a really good 19-year run of Pat Murphy and Paul Maneri. It was really the best age of Notre Dame, even though Jake Klein's name is on the stadium and he was there for over four decades and did some great things. I mean, really the golden age of Notre Dame baseball were those two coaches, Murphy and Maneri. And I don't see why Notre Dame can't be more competitive in the ACC. I think it's a great league, but I think Notre Dame has a lot of resources and should be able to sell its name in the 4x40, 4 for 40 campaign
sure.
to be able to have a better baseball team. Indiana University is a lot better baseball program right now than Notre Dame is. I realize they're not in the ACC, but geographically, there's not a huge difference between Bloomington and South Bend from a climate standpoint. A little bit warmer in Bloomington, but you're in the same state. And I think Notre Dame just needs to do a better job. I mean, again, offensively, really good pitching. You know, what would have happened if Cole Kmet says, I'm playing only football only this year?
Good question. Well, four Big Ten teams made the NCAA tournament. Minnesota, Ohio State, Purdue, and Indiana. And I'll say this. To be fair, if those four teams are playing the ACC schedule, do they still make the NCAA tournament? I think it's a fair question to ask because there is a big difference between the Big Ten and the ACC. The Big Ten is better than the Big East days, in my opinion, but it is not in the same classification as the schedule Notre Dame plays in the ACC. So maybe two of those teams still make it. There's no way all four make it if they are playing an ACC-type schedule. Now, Minnesota won the Big Ten tournament crown. They beat Purdue. And from what I've read, and there's actually a Minnesota player on our South Bend Cubs team, that's a really good Minnesota team that could compete with a lot of teams across the country. So I don't want to use the Big Ten got four teams in, why can't Notre Dame be better? Because I think it is a whole different ballgame in terms of the level of competition that they are playing compared to what the ACC teams are playing. This is just a generic thought. And I think this is very small on the Richter scale. But just the last couple of years for fun, when I'm around South Bend Cubs pitchers, we get into conversations about different things. Sometimes it's baseball, sometimes it's not. And one thing I like to ask the guys is, since most of them played college baseball, the American-born players I'm talking about that pitch with South Bend the last couple of years, and I asked them about the field turf pitching mound that Notre Dame has at X Stadium. Now, if you haven't been over to X, there's not a piece of dirt on the property now. The sliding boxes and the infield and home plate and the pitcher's mound are all field turf. And I asked them, if you were being recruited to a place that had a field turf pitching mound, would it make you think about not going there? And I have not had one person say that it would not be a factor. They think it is a factor because, let's face it, pitchers dig in at the rubber. It's a different landing feeling from what I'm told. Now, I've never thrown on a field turf mound, so I don't know if this matters at all in recruiting. I mean, you talked about the hitting is good. The pitching is being developed right now, and maybe that's a question for Cole Kmet if we can get an answer out of him about that. Again, I don't know if it's a factor, but just everybody I talk to that's a professional pitcher, and if they would be in a situation to be recruited in college, would it factor in? And I've not had one person say it would not be a factor.
That's very interesting.
I don't know. Again, I'm talking about, this is 12 to 15 guys I've asked. It's not like it's a 200 or 500 group of people I've asked, but the 12 to 15 just say it is a different feel. They've obviously pitched in different facilities that have it, and it's just a whole different feel of pitching, because I did notice when you go to a game at X Stadium, they'll actually fill in a little indention in the mound with like the little particles and stuff. It's kind of strange to think about, but there is a little indention. Apparently the landing spot still occurs when you have that field turf mound, so it is different. I don't know if it's a factor or not. We'll see how recruiting goes in the next couple of years for the Fighting Irish. But, you know, there is hope they could be a 500 team at least. If you can go 500 in the ACC, Eric, I think that's the starting point of success. I think if you can get to that level, you're playing really, really good baseball considering the competition you go up against. And, again, I don't want to make excuses, but there are disadvantages to being Notre Dame and trying to build a baseball program in the ACC. It's extremely difficult to compete against these schools that are filled with first-round picks who want to go to the warm weather, and they want to play in the bright sunshine, and they want to play in February in their home ballpark.
Right. You know, somebody texted me and made the point about the number of scholarships that baseball has, and they don't have a fully funded team. So again,
there you if go. You, great point.
Yeah, so you've got, yeah, it is a really good point. So if you're not on scholarship, your parents have, or you and your parents have to fork out a lot of money to be able to play baseball at Notre Dame, and that's a more difficult sell than at, say, a state school. That does, you know, other Stanford, you have to pay that too. But state schools, you've got some state schools in the ACC, North Carolina and Florida State and the like. So that is a disadvantage for Notre Dame baseball.
That's a fantastic point. I did realize that, so I'm really glad that person brought that up. Well, it can be done. We've seen Craig Counsell, Aaron Heilman, Trey Mancini, A.J. Pollock, David Phelps. You know, there's been a good group that's come through here, so you can get great players here. We'll see if things start to get better. 24-30 this year, always a tough go in the ACC. All right, we'll take a timeout. My five question of the day comes your way next from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader.
One question, five answers. This is the My Five Question of the Day on Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
We haven't played a football game yet, but let's ask the five Notre Dame football players that have had the best 2018 so far. We start with number five.
Well, you know, and these aren't the five best players on the team. These are the guys that have the best 2018 so far. So I got to tie at five, and they're both quarterbacks. One is Brandon Wimbush because I think he did enough to establish himself as 1A going into the summer and maybe just one, and Brian Kelly being diplomatic there. The other is Avery Davis, turning himself into a hybrid player. You know, there's a lot of intrigue with him going into August because he certainly was a fun guy to watch in the spring and looks like he's for real.
Number four.
I'm going to go with cornerback Troy Pride. You know, that cornerback group is really competitive, and it would have been really easy for Nick Watkins or Sean Crawford and Julian Love kind of push Troy into the background. But he continued what he did late last season, becoming more and more consistent, getting better with his mental game. Now he pairs that with his 4.3 speed in the 40, and you've got a guy that's ascending.
The five Notre Dame football players who have had the best 2018 so far, number three.
We'll go with Alex Bars. Alex was not initially voted a captain, but won kind of the runoff election at the end of spring based on a spring performance. And I think he and Sam Mustipher are the leaders on the offense. And I think Alex Bars probably is a guy that's going to get some national recognition this year. Maybe not to the level of Quentin Nelson last year with all the highlights, but I think he's going to be a really good player.
Number two.
Number two, Miles Boykin. He started with a great January 1st with an opportunity and the game-winning catch against LSU, and he has just rode that momentum and become the alpha dog of the wide receiver core.
And number one.
I'm going to go with Drew Tranquil. For the second year in a row, this guy changes positions, makes it look pretty simple. Another captain. You just watch him at inside linebacker and say, hasn't he been playing this for a while? So Drew Tranquil gets number one for me.
We're back in 2 minutes. Sports Beat on WSB.
Here's Eric Hansen with what's coming up in tomorrow's South Bend Tribune Sports Section.
Tyler James has the latest on Notre Dame football commitment, punter Jay Bramlett. South Bend Cubs, we get it in today. It was a day game and much, much more.
Eric, thank you. Sean joins me in just a moment. It is the top of the hour at 96.1 WSBT South Bend.
Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT presents Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Booger, up and in! With 2 seconds left, Notre Dame leads!
Malpas again, backhands, he scores!
Down to the corner, Jablonski, three is good!
Andrew steps in, he's going to throw deep for T.Y., he's got it!
Flips to Jenkins, three for the win, it's good! Villanova wins it!
He tied, it is a touchdown! New England wins!
Adios! Cubs win their ninth in a row!
Miles Boykin is in the end zone! The Irish have come back!
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
And welcome back to Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. It is now 7 minutes after the top of the hour. Sean Stiers back in our WSBT studios. I'm Darren Pritchett, traveling with the South Bend Cubs up in Midland, Michigan. Where we had a first pitch today of 74 degrees and bright sunshine. It was supposed to rain today. The rain has held off so far, unlike what's happening in South Bend today. I think it's a good thing we're on the road today.
Kind of sounds like it. Still nice up there. We're getting it right now. It got here a little later than we were supposed to get it, but we're getting it now anyway.
Long as it's clear by Friday when we come back home to open a six-game homestand, I guess I'll be greedy and say, bah, let it rain today, right? I'm not there. What does it matter?
There you go.
Isn't that awful? All right, we got rapid fire coming up at the bottom of the hour. We'll recap what happened today with the South Bend Cubs. How about the 76ers fiasco? That was a part of CBS Sports Update in which the general manager has burner accounts. I got to be honest, I had never heard burner account used before until this popped up. I know there are fake accounts. Right. There was, what, Brian Van Gorder's mustache had a Twitter account. I mean, there's all sorts of things that get Twitter accounts.
Different
I'm sure
inanimate objects with their own Twitter. Yeah, the bucket, or the trash can or whatever down there at Tennessee and all these
crazy
things.
That's right. And you know what? Had there been Twitter when Bob Knight threw the chair across the floor, Bob Knight's chair would have had a Twitter account.
That's right.
But this apparently, we'll talk about it more later, the GM had fake accounts and was feeding information and criticizing players and kind of pumping up the GM a little bit. I mean, how bizarre. And that's Jerry Angelo's son, isn't it? The old son's owner?
Jerry Colangelo.
Jerry Colangelo.
Yeah.
He is such a well-respected man. To see his son do something like this, if it's true, and the 76ers are going through an audit of the situation, but apparently someone's already done the research that these four or five accounts all go back to the same phone number, and apparently, if you're Philadelphia, you probably have his phone number, so you could check it out.
Yeah, that's true.
And it won't take too long. So, really strange situation taking place in Philadelphia. All right, the Cubs in action tonight against the Pirates. The White Sox have already lost to the Indians today, and it's the eighth time this season the White Sox have been swept in a series. Ronaldo Lopez, who has been great this year, got roughed up today, and he was beaten by Corey Kluber. And so the Indians take care of the White Sox today. So, South Bend Cubs won in Great Lakes by a score of 5-3. We'll touch on that a little bit more in just a couple of moments. And just to go back to last hour again, we were supposed to have Mike Rooney on the program, former Notre Dame baseball player, one of the voices of ESPN's college baseball coverage, but he's got a rough voice right now, so he's going to save it for this weekend, and we're going to hook up either next week or before the College World Series gets underway. All right, we tried to make contact with Kaylee Rooker from St. Joe, Michigan. She received a sponsor's exemption to the Four Winds Invitational at Blackthorn Golf Club. She's actually a great story. She is active in the first tee of Benton Harbor. She actually got her start in golf through that program, from what I understand. First team All-State up at St. Joe, USGA Junior Qualifier in 2017. And she received the sponsor's exemption into the Four Winds Invitational, the Symetra Tour professional event, June 8th through the 10th at Blackthorn Golf Club. And we were going to talk to Kaylee today, but we've been unable to reach her, so we will move right along in the proceedings. We'll have more on the Four Winds Invitational coming up on Saturday at 8 a.m. with another installment of The Golf Show here on 96.1 WSBT. Let me pick up on something, Sean, that you're very familiar with, and something Eric and I talked about in the first hour of the program. We debated what we should have as a standard for Notre Dame baseball. Now, you spent a lot of time calling Notre Dame baseball games in our market. You were the voice of the Fighting Irish when they went to the College World Series in 2002. You got to spend a lot of time at Rosenblatt Stadium in Omaha, which is the center of the college baseball world. And you saw some great Notre Dame teams back in the day in the Big East Conference. So I'd really like your insight on a couple of these things.
Okay.
Here's the first thing we talked about. When Notre Dame was having great success, it was in the Big East compared to the ACC. When Paul Menary was in charge of the program, and when they were in the Big East, they were having 50-win seasons. I mean, is it fair to say, and I hope I'm not wrong on this, and please jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was basically Notre Dame and Rutgers were kind of the top two teams. BC, West Virginia kind of danced around a little bit. Pittsburgh, I guess. But wasn't it Notre Dame and Rutgers mainly for 5-6 years? Weren't they the cream of the crop? Am I missing somebody?
For the most part. I mean, there were years toward the end of the Big East. Obviously, Louisville came along when some of those teams came in from Conference USA, Louisville and Cincinnati. So especially Louisville, that upped the bar a bit. There was a couple years where UConn was pretty good when George Springer, Matt Barnes, LJ Mazzilli, those guys were out there. They went to a super regional, and St. John's has had every couple years St. John's usually has a pretty good team. So I mean, as far as the old Big East goes, Rutgers and St. John's, West Virginia always had good offense, really struggled to find good pitching, but those were kind of the prime teams. Pittsburgh, I think, had a couple decent teams as well. And actually, you mentioned BC. There, it was kind of every few years when Pete Hughes was back there, and Mick Aoki worked for Pete Hughes. They had a few teams. So, I mean, but so, yeah, those were kind of the main suspects, as well as Notre Dame.
When you were broadcasting, was Jed Jerko at West Virginia?
He was.
Okay.
He was.
I thought you might have broadcasted him.
Yep.
So, you're kind of the expert on this of our group, since you were on college baseball and you were really into it and followed it very closely. So this is really tough to ask, but give me your best shot here. When you think back to those really good Notre Dame teams from the late 90s and the early 2000s, if they were playing in today's ACC, do you think those Notre Dame teams would have been above 500? Would they have been a team that might have threatened for a chance to be one of the top seeds in the ACC tournament, or I guess dream big? Do you think they would have been able to stay in competition for a regular season title?
Now, we're talking about those specific teams as they were constructed with Paul as the head coach
Why don't we use 2002 as the ceiling?
Okay.
I mean, that was, at least by results at the end of the year, the best team because they went to the College World Series. Yeah. Now, you could probably argue there might have been another team that was better, but in terms of results at the end of the year, this team had the trip to the College World Series. So let's just use them to kind of narrow it down. You take that team and you put them in today's ACC, and what do you get?
Man, I mean, that's tough because, one, there ended up being some good pitchers on that team, but start off with the fact that that team specifically had zero pitchers make All Big East that year.
No kidding.
Because there were just some different dynamics. Both Grant Johnson and Chris Neisel, who ended up being kind of the two best pitchers on that team, they were both freshmen. Neisel had mono throughout the year, so you know he really didn't hit his stride. He started out pretty well, but he really didn't hit his stride again because he was out for several weeks until kind of the postseason was coming. So that team was just so unique because of just all these different dynamics that came into play. JP Gagne going to the bullpen. He was a starter for a good chunk of the season. He goes to the bullpen toward the end and becomes this big closer. Offensively, I think they were there. Again, it's hard to say because that ends up being the penultimate team. But I've got to think if they're competing in the ACC every week, they're probably a middle-of-the-pack team because they weren't. You know, the year before, they had Aaron Heilman, who ends up being a first-round pick, Danny Tamayo, who was also drafted and made it as high as AAA. So that team was actually a little bit better built, you know, in terms of pitching and being able to compete week in and week out in the ACC. So, I think it would have been, they would have probably been somewhere middle of the pack to upper, you know, lower upper half in terms of if they had to be in a league like the ACC every week.
Interesting. That's really interesting. Well, I made the comment last hour. I think to me, with Notre Dame and the ACC for baseball, if you're 500, that's an awfully good season considering the disadvantages that you have compared to other ACC teams. To me, if you can get to the 500 mark in conference play, that's an awfully good season. Anything above that is gravy. And I don't want to set low standards, but I just think it's a whole different ballgame being in the ACC. And Eric got a text from someone in the know, and it was a great point to throw out there that Notre Dame does not have the full scholarship boat to hand out to players like other teams too, so they have to share scholarships, and some people don't have, you know, they have to spend a lot of money to go to Notre Dame. So I mean, that takes away, I mean, a percentage of players who could possibly play at Notre Dame.
It's not just Notre Dame though, it's college baseball wide, and it's the biggest difference. It's the biggest difference College baseball is different than any of the other sports, especially specifically when you look at football and basketball when you're competing in the ACC or whatever big conference, because all college baseball programs only get 11.7 scholarships to divvy out. And you're talking about a roster of 30 to 35 guys, and you've got to give a minimum scholarship of 25% to everybody. So 25% is your starting point. At a private school like Notre Dame, Vanderbilt, Stanford, Duke, wherever it happens to be, Wake Forest, 25% there is a lot different than 25% at, say, IU or Purdue, where your tuition is around $10,000 a year, and you're talking about $60,000 a year at Notre Dame. And then you go to a state like Florida. I looked this up the other day because Evan Sharpley and I were talking about it. Florida's in-state tuition for any state school in Florida is $6,000 a year.
Wow.
So think about that when you're talking about a talent-rich state, warm weather, year-round, $6,000 a year to go to Florida or Florida State, which are perennial national powers. So you're talking about, if you're divvying it up 25% there, it's pretty darn affordable for the guys who aren't getting as much scholarship money, whereas You're talking about out of pocket to come to any private school, Notre Dame included. That's a lot more money. And so then when you factor that into the fact that you're trying to compete, like you look at the ACC this year, they just got four teams that were seeded among the top 16 teams in the country going into the NCAA tournament. So four teams, and two of them were in the top eight. And then, so that's your competition level in the ACC. And when you're that 11.7, just say it hamstrings a private school a heck of a lot more than it does any state school. And then, so if you go back to that time in the Big East, you've got a lot more schools like Notre Dame, where they're private Catholic schools. They're dealing with the same type deal, and you throw in the weather and the whole thing. But now you go to a conference like the ACC, where you've had seven teams get to Omaha in the last 8 years, and most of them are repeat teams, and Virginia won a national championship. So I mean, it's just a lot different when you talk about the scholarship allotment that, again, is college baseball wide. You only get 11.7 to distribute among your whole roster every year. It's just a big difference. And I really, I don't know that the NCAA has ever looked at it, but I mean, I feel like there needs to be some kind of exemption where a private school can give more. But you've got, obviously, the reason for it is Title IX, because you look at a softball roster, they get 12, but on average, a college softball roster has about 15 fewer student athletes than a baseball roster.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So am I setting the standard too low that a 500 record in the ACC is a really, really good season?
You know what? It's interesting you say that, because I was watching the selection show for the NCAA tournament the other day, and here's an example. Ray Tanner was the committee chairman this year, and Ray Tanner's the athletic director at South Carolina now. He was the head coach at South Carolina when they won their back-to-back national championships about 7 or 8 years ago. So he's the athletic director. He's the committee chair, which is, like, as far as baseball goes, you've got the perfect guy being your committee chair. But they talked about Kentucky. Kentucky ended up like four games under 500 in the SEC, but they had an RPI of 30, and they got left out. And what Ray Tanner was saying in the interview after they announced everything is, one of the big things the committee looked at was being 500, at least 500, in your conference. And so now you've got Purdue and Indiana as examples that both got at-large bids, which is, I think, the first time that's ever happened in the state of Indiana, both of those schools getting in at the same time. So, I mean, that's great for them. But 500 in the Big Ten is a lot different than 500 in the SEC, but that's the standard that they were holding teams to. Are you 500 in your conference? So Kentucky gets left out. So, I mean, I think that's got to be your starting point. Can we be 500 in the ACC, and you kind of work from there? Because if you're 500 in the ACC, all that RPI and other stuff is probably going to work itself out.
See, that's what I said to Eric. Four teams from the Big Ten got in: Minnesota, the tournament champion, Ohio State, Indiana, Purdue. If they're in the ACC, how many teams make the tournament playing that schedule?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's,
two, maybe?
And,
maybe?
You know, and should also say the Big Ten has made some strides in the last few years in the way they do things. I mean, they used to be like the Big East, where they were only getting one bid, two bids if they were lucky, but now they've got five, and they've had, kind of on a rotating basis, they've had Illinois a few years ago, Minnesota this year, that have had some really good seasons, you know? So, I mean, they've kind of done a better job of investing, but you're absolutely right. I mean, if you put those any of those Big Ten teams in the ACC, I don't think they're sitting around 500 either.
No, I don't think so either. Hey, since we're talking about baseball, something exciting coming up Saturday, I think you're going to be involved with it. So why don't you tell our listeners what's coming up on WSBT Radio?
Yeah, we're going to go over to LaPorte, and we've got a little special presentation of some 4A regional high school baseball, Mishawaka against Penn. It's going to start at about 2 o'clock, and both of those teams won their sectionals on Monday. And, of course, you've got a big rivalry with these two teams playing in regionals, and a couple of really hot teams, too. Penn's won 21 straight games. Mishawaka's won 13 of their last 15 games, so they're really hot. So it should be a lot of fun. We're going to go over there to LaPorte and have the broadcast of Mishawaka against Penn in the regional semifinal, and it'll start at about 2 o'clock South Bend time here on WSBT.
It's so funny. I've heard from a couple of people who follow high school baseball that, well, maybe Penn's down a little bit this year. Well, first of all, their standard is, I mean, to the roof. Second of all, they've won 21 in a row,
that's
so
right.
I'm not sure how you
but
can say
down.
That. Boy, I'd really hate to see a down year. They only went 12 in a row or something. Pretty remarkable. Oh, that's going to be fun. Penn and Mishawaka over in LaPorte. And again, Saturday, you're on the air at what time?
A little before 2 o'clock. There's a game before that between Lake Central and Chesterton, and so it's kind of one of those, wait for that game to end, and then a little bit less than an hour after that game ends is when Mishawaka Penn is supposed to begin. So the first one starts at around 11:30, so hopefully we're on the air somewhere right around 2 o'clock.
Well, I wish you good luck. That's going to be awesome, and I hope you get plenty of statistics from the two teams because I'd like to learn about these two squads. That's going to be fun to listen to.
I'm working on it.
All right, awesome. All right, so that's coming up Saturday at around 2 o'clock. Penn versus Mishawaka live on WSBT Radio in regional baseball action. Coming up next, Sean will host Rapid Fire. It's coming up on 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. Sean Stiers, Darren Pritchett with you here on WSBT Radio. It is now halfway through this hour, and we get to another installment of Rapid Fire.
Darren, former Notre Dame safety Harrison Smith, who of course is with the Minnesota Vikings, comes in at number 46 on the list of the NFL's top 100 players just released. So, do you think the ranking's too high, too low, or just about right?
Boy, oh boy. You know, safeties sometimes don't get the credit they deserve. He's in the top 50, so that's pretty high praise. That means he's ahead of a lot of quarterbacks and a lot of position players. And considering the impact he has had on that Vikings defense the last few years, including last year, you know, it's hard to say, should it be 60, 35? I'm just going to say it's just about the right spot because, to me, without a doubt, he's one of the best 75 football players in the National Football League. How do you sort him out? It's tough since they're different positions. So I'm just going to say that's probably about right. I would have guessed he would have been somewhere between 50 and 60, so I'll be okay with 46.
Okay, yeah, he came in at number 74 on the list this year, so it's a pretty big
jump. Oh, 74? I thought you said 46.
I'm sorry. I think I said he was 74th last year. He jumps up to 46 this year. So a pretty big jump for him. And you look at his stats. He matched his career high with 5 interceptions, set a new career high with 12 passes defended, and also had 78 tackles. And I've got to think the reason he comes in so high on the list is because Minnesota was so reliant on its defense. I mean, they had your new guy, Case Keenum, as the quarterback. I mean, he played well, but, I mean, let's face it. He wasn't the guy that Minnesota started off the season with at quarterback. So their two best defensive players, Harrison Smith and Xavier Rhodes, who was just a few spots lower than Smith, are both on this list. They're two defensive players. I think again, because of how much Minnesota had to lean on its defense, I think it's got to be about right, number 46 for Harrison Smith. Okay, so now with Smith on the list, Notre Dame has two former players in this NFL top 100, with Smith at 46. Zach Martin came in at 71st. We talked about him a few weeks back when he showed up on the list. So do you think any other former Notre Dame guys will be in the top 40 now as this list gets released here over the next few weeks?
I mean, I would have to imagine, Sean, that Zach Martin on any list, even though it's not the same position, would be ahead of Ronnie Stanley. So if Stanley's name has not been called yet, I can't believe it's going to be called at this point. I mean, Stanley 30, 35 spots ahead of Zach, that just doesn't seem likely.
Right.
So no, I'll probably say Harrison will be the last Notre Dame name called on that list.
And I tend to agree, because I think if there was going to be another name, it would have been Stanley. And I think it would have been somewhere maybe in the 80s and 90s if he were going to show up. And so I think we would have seen, if there was going to be another one, I think we would have seen him by now. Tyler Eifert was on the list a couple years ago, but he hasn't been healthy enough
right
the last couple years. He's really been limited. So I don't think that we're going to see any more this year, but I think that we all think that we'll probably see at least one more next year, if not maybe a couple more. The one to keep an eye on is Jalen Smith, because I just saw some stuff. They're doing their OTA down there in Dallas today, and it looks like he's come along really well. He doesn't have that brace on anymore. So, if he can be Notre Dame Jalen Smith,
oh, yeah,
he's a guy to watch out for next year.
And that'll make that second-round pick seem like a steal.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, let's shift to some baseball. Do you buy or sell Albert Almora Jr. needing to be the Cubs' full-time center fielder and leadoff man?
Boy, oh boy. If David Kaplan from ESPN 1000 was sitting here, he'd be screaming, yes. You know, I'm not as sold on Almora as he is, and he is much closer and has better contacts with the Cubs than I do. He's having a great year this year, and I'm just going to bring up what I brought up recently when you were asking about, do the Cubs have to make a trade at the deadline? Mm-hmm. And I just feel like, do you want Almora as your center fielder in the postseason? And I'm not sold on that. Now, I've got a couple of months to watch him play more and see what he does as the season goes on, to maybe change my answer. But as we sit here today, I feel like I'd want somebody else playing center field. I like Happ as a corner outfielder. I'm not thrilled with him in center from a defensive standpoint. So
I guess that would be my question. Who's it going to be if not Almora? Because
I know.
Because he's head and shoulders better than Ian Happ in center field. So,
and are you going to play Hayward every day? Hayward can play center. He doesn't like playing center. He loses defensive value playing center compared to right field, but he can play there. But as you get closer to the deadline, there's a lot of teams tanking or not going to be in the race, so there's going to be probably some players to choose from. So as I sit here today, I'm not really thrilled about Almora being my everyday center fielder, but if he continues to impress and over the next couple of months, I'll change my mind. But right now, I think I'm grab bagging a little bit in center field.
Interesting. So here's the breakdown on Almora in terms of when he starts. The Cubs, as a team, 20-10 when he starts. And he pinch hit the other day, played center field, yesterday actually, in Pittsburgh. So after that, they're 8-7 when he plays but doesn't start. So in other words, when he comes in off the bench, they're 8-7 in those games. They're 0-5 when he doesn't play at all. So, I mean, how much is him? I don't know, but
I know
his on base percentage is .388 when he's in the leadoff spot, which is about 120 points better than Ian Happ in the leadoff spot, and about 50 points better than Ben Zobrist. And those have been kind of the three main leadoff guys. So there's a lot of data that's starting to track in Almora's favor. I really like him. Of all the options they have, I definitely like him as the center fielder. Is he the best option? I don't know, but of the options they have, I think he's the best.
Sean, I'll say this. The key is, he's hitting right-handed pitching this year.
Yeah.
You look at 2017, he hit .342 against lefties with a .411 on base. Against righties, he was at .271. The on-base percentage was at .291. This year against righties, .306 with a .358 on-base percentage. So that makes him more of an everyday guy than he used to be. So I guess I'm holding on to last year. I'm holding on to the fact that maybe the numbers are a little skewed at this time. Let's see how it plays out. Give me another month and a half, and maybe I'll change my answer. But I'm still very hesitant to go all in with him as my everyday center fielder. But the numbers don't lie, and I could see if Joe Maddon goes that direction. I can't argue it.
All right. Give you another baseball question. I'm interested to get your thought on this. Former Cubs prospect Gleyber Torres continues to tear it up for the Yankees. Yeah, I know, right? Who knew? We've talked before about there being no regrets trading him for Aroldis Chapman because it helped the Cubs win that long elusive championship. But how differently do you think the feeling would be if the Cubs had lost that World Series?
It would be DEFCON 5 right now. It's what it could be if the Cubs don't win a World Series with Quintana and Eloy Jimenez just blows up for the White Sox. I mean, that's going to be DEFCON 5. So, you know, that's a great question. If the Cubs don't win that World Series, I think there are a lot of ticked off Cub fans. And I guess I get if they're upset now, but I just stand by my thought. If you win the World Series, it was a great move. And again, I don't believe they win the World Series without Chapman.
Completely
he was
agree.
A key part, even though there were the struggles in Game 7 and the overuse and all that talk. They don't even get there without Chapman.
Right.
So the deal
would
made
that have
sense
been enough
at the time.
Just getting to the World Series if they had lost?
No.
Do you think that would even be enough?
I need the trophy.
Yeah.
The trophy for me. So, no, I still have no regrets, and if they had not won the World Series, it's hard to say the trade worked out, because it's all about the trophy. That was a move to win the World Series.
That's right.
Not to be competitive, not to finally get to the World Series for the first time since 45. It was to win the bad boy. They did it, but if they got to the World Series, or if they didn't make it to the World Series, it'd be awfully hard to say that was a successful trade. And that's why I'm holding that standard to the Jimenez, Cease, Quintana deal. I think it's to be continued. You know, I didn't like it at the time. I still don't like it. But if they win the World Series, I'll like it.
Yeah. And that's winning takes care of pretty much everything.
It sure does.
I mean, that's kind of what it's all. And winning a World Series for an organization like the Cubs, the Red Sox, those teams that you had to hear all the long suffering, the curse of the Bambino, the curse of the Billy Goat. And that's what, I mean, we would still be hearing Billy Goats and curses. That's what we would be hearing if the Cubs would have lost that World Series. And then Cubs fans would be sitting there looking at Gleyber Torres, American League Player of the Week last week after hitting 5 home runs and 1158 OPS. And he's now got 9 home runs, 24 ribbies in his first 31 major league games. So, I mean, when you balance all that success in the Bronx for Gleyber Torres if they hadn't won that World Series. And then in the meantime, we're having conversations about whether it should be Albert Almora or Ian Happ out there in the outfield. And plus, you've still got Jason Hayward and that huge albatross of a contract. The conversation is just a lot different if they don't win the whole thing.
I wonder a rapid-fire question of the future will be, which contract is worse, Hayward or Darvish?
Ooh, man.
Right now it's Hayward because he's been involved with the contract longer. Darvish, we're still months in. So can he turn around? I don't know. He's on the DL again. But that might be an interesting question that could pop up if things don't turn around.
All right. I jotted something down. And I've got a different spin on that. We'll hit this tomorrow.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Okay. Last question for today. It's an NFL related question. Dallas quarterback Dak Prescott had this to say recently in the wake of the Cowboys parting ways with Dez Bryant. Quote, "I don't know if any team in the league necessarily needs a number one receiver. It's about getting the ball out, spreading the ball around, keeping the defense on its toes," end quote. So, do you buy or sell that rationale?
That's a loaded loaded question. Because you know what's funny? I don't think it's the same situation at running back. Outside of some guys, Larry Fitzgerald is a different character. I mean, he's a wonderful teammate, great guy.
Not like
all about
most of
the
divas.
That's what I'm getting at. A lot of the great receivers have got diva in them.
Yep.
Remember Randy Moss?
Yep.
Terrell Owens, you had him down in Dallas. Yep. I mean, they're absolutely headaches. Chad Johnson or Ocho DeCinco, whatever he was called at the time. Would you call Dez Bryant a diva? I think it was fair to say
absolutely.
In Dallas he was
absolutely
one.
Absolutely he was, yeah.
So a lot of the great guys, you just have to bear with all the drama and get me the football, I'm open, didn't you see me? Sometimes it's better to have a balanced set of wide receivers and tight ends to distribute the football. But it never hurts to have that one guy that can make that game-deciding play, and the guys we just mentioned, most of those guys can do that. So if I can find me a Larry Fitzgerald that's not going to cause me headaches and can be elite, sign me up. But you know what? I got to be honest, and you can probably add on more to this than I can. But to me, over the last year and a half, Dez Bryant's skills have eroded to the point where he's not worth the headache. And I wonder if that has something to do with the fact that Dez Bryant is still a free agent at this stage of the offseason.
I think that's part of it, and I think that you've got a young quarterback like Prescott, and you've got this big personality, a guy who used to be really good just a couple of years ago before he had the bad injury himself to his ankle, Dez Bryant, who's not quite what he used to be, but also there's this feeling that because he's that number one guy and he has this history, that there was just this pressure that he had, that the offense needed to run through him, through Bryant, that you always have to look for him first and then work off of that. And I just think it was too much for a guy like Dak Prescott, and really any quarterback, because I think when you look at it, like look at the Patriots as your model. And, I mean, with the exception of those couple years where Randy Moss was there in New England, what Prescott is talking about is how Tom Brady and the Patriots have run their offense. There's really never been a true number one. Now, they've used those slot guys, and they've put up some big numbers and stuff like that. But from week to week, I mean, it's been Welker, Amendola, and Edelman. So, I mean, it's always week to week been a different guy, especially probably the first 10 years or so of that Patriots dynasty where the ball is always going through somebody else. I think even maybe New Orleans with Drew Brees is like that to an extent. They haven't really had really big stars. They've had good receivers, but I don't know that they've had stars. So, I mean, I think in a perfect world, that's how it is, especially for a younger guy. And for a younger guy, I think there probably is a lot more pressure to try to on every play, be thinking, I've got to try to work through him first instead of just making a good read and putting the ball in there like he's talking about.
And you just kind of created the debate with New England. With all these no-name wide receivers they've had throughout the years, with exceptions like Moss, is Tom Brady just making them a whole lot better?
That's a good
question.
Now,
when Amendola, he left New England this year, is he going to be the same guy? If Edelman ever left the Patriots, would he be the same guy?
Right.
I mean, Tom puts the ball in a really good spot for those receivers. Now, on the flip side, let me list you a name of players. Kendall Wright, Joshua Bellamy, Dontrell Inman, Zach Miller, Deion Sims, Trey McBride, and Daniel Brown. Do you know what those guys have in common?
All Patriots receivers?
All Chicago Bears wide receivers.
Really?
They were the leading wide receiver / tight end pass catchers for the Chicago Bears last year. Kendall Wright had 59 catches. Joshua Bellamy had 24. Now, Tarik Cohen out of the backfield had 53. Dontrell Inman, 23. Cunningham, 20. Miller, 20. Sims, 15. Brown, 13. And on down the list you go. So if you're a Chicago Bear fan and you hear us whining about having a diva and all the problems, they would kill to have a diva right now for Trubisky to throw the football to. Now, they have made some free agent signings in trying to improve that group. So hopefully that will be the case. But you just think about the group that they had last year. I mean, that's really tough on a rookie quarterback to have guys that can't make an impact. I mean, Kevin White, a high draft pick, he's going into his fourth year. Yeah. Does anybody remember Kevin White at this point? He can't stay healthy.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's a good point. But you wonder at the same time, though, because Trubisky's so young, if maybe that it's in some way helps him out. He's just got a group of guys out there, and again, just find the guy. I'm sure at some point they'll end up with somebody a little bit bigger. Maybe Trubisky will make a star out of him. But that's a good point.
They hope Allen Robinson, coming from Jacksonville, will be a big play receiver. Had a knee injury in the first game of last year, missed the rest of the year, had a big year the year before, so maybe that's a guy that will turn into their alpha wide receiver in Chicago. And just looking up Kevin White really quick, the fourth-year pro out of West Virginia, seventh overall pick in 2015. In 2017, he had two catches, and in 2016, he had 35 catches, and that's it. For the seventh overall pick in the draft. Tough, tough, tough. That's Rapid Fire for today. More Sports Beat coming up in just a moment from 96.1 WSBT, the Sports. Abby, thank you very much for the forecast update. 9 minutes in front of the top of the hour. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, 96.1 WSBT, the Sports Leader. Brought to you by Budweiser, Blackthorn Golf Club, and the Blackthorn Card, and Goshen Heart and Vascular. Sean Steyer's back at our WSBT studios. I'm Darren Pritchett, traveling with the South Bend Cubs in Midland, Michigan. South Bend and Great Lakes, they have played two games of this three-game series. Last night was not a whole lot of fun. Well, it was early. It was 3-0 South Bend going to the bottom of the third. And then Great Lakes just spoiled the fun and scored 12 of the next 13 runs. And South Bend lost 12-4. But they bounced back today and won 5-3. And the Cubs' excellent starting pitching continued today. Riley Lacy out of Creighton University, a 10th round pick of the Cubs last summer, struck out a career-best 8 today, 5 innings, 2 runs. He picked up his first professional victory. And when you add Lacy's starting totals today to the last 25 other South Bend starts, here is the result. 21 of the last 26 South Bend Cubs starting pitchers have allowed 2 or fewer runs in their start. So you should be way over 500, right, with that type of numbers?
Yeah.
In the last 26 games covering this stat, the Cubs are 13-13. Defense, offense, and bullpen very inconsistent. But to go back to the starting rotation, in those 26 starts, the ERA for the group is 2.56. 40 earned runs in 140 and two-thirds innings. A 2.56 ERA from your rotation for almost a full month? That's pretty doggone good, but unfortunately... Here's one of the issues. Over the last 19 games, South Bend has committed 34 errors.
Oh, man.
They had 3 last night, 2 today, so 5 in the series. And, of course, May 18th at Fort Wayne. The last time, or I should say it would have been 2 starts ago for Lacy, he was on the mound when the Cubs committed 7 errors behind him in the first 4 innings. And there could have been an 8th. I think they threw up the white flag in Fort Wayne. They ran out of ease at that particular moment. But the Cubs' offense has been very hit and miss. They're hitting around .238 as a team. So it's a group that's played well at times, and then they've struggled. I just want to see them put it all together for a week. We just haven't seen all facets of the game come together all at once. Hopefully it will come. And maybe with the draft, and if the Cubs take more position players like people are speculating, you know, that could help South Bend down the line. We're probably going to lose a couple of our starting pitchers to Advance A, I would assume, in the next month. But maybe the draft will bring us some players because Ian Happ arrived in South Bend. Oh, gosh, it was probably for 38, 39 games in 2015. So that could really change the complexion of the South Bend team. They just need a little more offense, and I think they could be a team that could make a run for a playoff spot in the second half. But we'll have to see what the Cubs decide. The fate is in the hands of Theo and his group, and how the South Bend season's going to go, to be quite frank.
Absolutely, and it's coming up here pretty soon. What? I think
Monday.
Is it just Monday? That's what I was going to say. I thought we were less than 2 weeks away.
Yeah, this is a rare hotel with the MLB Network, and they were talking about Monday. The draft gets underway with the Tigers being on the clock. So we've got that to look forward to coming up on Monday. All right, so South Bend will wrap up the series at Great Lakes. Tomorrow night at 7:05, Corey Abbott, second-round pick. He looks good. I'm a big fan. He will pitch for the Cubs tomorrow night. Then we're back home for a six-game homestand starting Friday at 7:35 against Lake County. Let's take our final break for this hour. Sean and I will be back in just a moment on 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat presented, as always, by our good friends at Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. We're also brought to you by Goshen Heart and Vascular. Know your numbers. Visit GoshenHeartAndVascular.org. And by Blackthorn Golf Club and the Blackthorn Cart, which is available right now, just $99. And among the features, you can get up to 80% off rounds of golf at Blackthorn, and that includes a cart. Only at Blackthorn Golf Club, which is the site of the Four Winds Invitational June 8th through the 10th. Sean, we will talk to you tomorrow. Enjoyed it as always. We'll talk to you then.
Sounds great. Talk to you tomorrow.
For Sean, I'm Darren. It's the top of the hour at WSBT South Bend.